Okay.
Jordan seems to be the first speaker. You there, Jordan?
Yeah, what's up?
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so this is a hard one for me because I definitely like completely agree with the, you know, standard SPGB, you know, take about if you, you know, start advocating for reforms, you might attract like people who only want those reforms, who aren't necessarily socialists, who don't have, you know, class consciousness and all that. I get it. Thing is, like just as a random example, the other day I saw on Twitter like a tweet that went viral of a mom who, I mean, I don't 100% know her situation, but from what I could guess, she probably didn't have anybody to take care of her kids. She had to go to work. Her kids were pretty young. I think one was 10, one was 2. So they were too young, you know, to not have a babysitter, but she left them alone. And I guess somebody found out, she got sent to jail. And a situation like that one hits really close to home for me because like my mom left us home alone around that age, you know, because like she wanted to do better than welfare. So it's like, it's really hard for me to look a mom in the face and tell her that something like universal child care wouldn't be, you know, a reasonable thing to fight for, you know, like regardless of what the reasoning is. Like, well, maybe that's not the right wording to use, but I think you guys know what I'm trying to say. Another big one for me is something like universal health care. You know, I know the NHS isn't perfect, of course, but, you know, you guys don't, at least from my to my understanding, you guys don't have people, you know, dying because of, you know, not having the money to pay for care. You guys don't have thousands and thousands of people like in America, you know, going into debt every year because of medical care. You guys aren't paying premiums from what I understand. I mean, maybe I'm sure you probably pay a little higher in taxes. I don't know how much, but you guys aren't paying, you know, like my premiums and everything go up every year at my job, you know, but yeah, it's like stuff like that is like a really hard one for me to like really look at and like say, that's not worth it. You know, like it. And that's kind of my take on it. Even though I 100% agree, there's just like tiny, there's like really big ones that I'm just like, I'm like kind of on the fence on, but whatever. That's pretty much my take.
Okay, but we're not saying we're opposed to all reforms. We just we're opposed to some, but we recognize that some are in the interests of workers. But if anybody else wants to add something, so Warwick, have you going to say something?
Sorry, I had to get rid of the noise. Good evening, everyone. I'm guilty of being involved on a daily basis in reformism, primarily because, well, for two reasons. One is I was a supporter of the Socialist Party here about 20 years ago, but activity tailed off and membership tailed off in Wellington. But secondly, and possibly more importantly, as an individual, you're confronted with concerns of a day-to-day nature that you want to be involved in. So I was so browned off with the situation of child poverty and the inaction of the fourth Labor government in the noughties that I joined the Workers' Party. And then about 5 years later, the Workers' Party affiliated with the Mana movement, which had been created. And I was an active member of that. And housing and child poverty became big concerns, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, a whole lot of issues. And you just get, as individuals, as workers, we get taken up with these issues because they're of concern and they're immediate. And how that relates to the activities of a socialist is maybe they're parallel. Maybe that we can confuse them sometimes, and I use that word advisedly, but maybe we have to accept that people will get bound up in the issues of the day, but with but still have a socialist philosophy. Yeah, I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Did you want to say anything about that, Mark, or shall I go on to the next one?
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Warwick. I'd be interested if anyone has any comments on that.
Okay. Let's see if they have. Mike Foster, you're next.
Evening. Thanks very much, Mark. And I hope you didn't mind repeating the last chunk of it, but I'm glad you did. Yeah, it was very interesting. Yeah, lots to ponder over. And I especially liked the parable at the beginning. I thought that was a very strong way of putting it. The thought that popped into my head is a criticism of the SPGB's stance. I can't remember where I first heard it, and I'm sure it doesn't carry much weight, but I can't really think of a way of articulating a reply to it. And the criticism is that while we focus on revolution as a goal and nothing but, at the same time, we're relying on other aspects of the workers' movement to push for reforms that we end up benefiting from. So that the accusation there is that we're sort of resting on other aspects of the workers' movement to keep or try to keep society at a fairly comfortable level, and that we benefit from that vicariously without sort of doing anything about it. And so I'm sure that's a weak argument. I was just wondering if anyone can think of a good way of articulating a response to that, because that's eluded me. Thank you. But very interesting talk, Mark. Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Okay, Darren, can you answer that?
No.
What you were going to say then? Okay.
First of all, thanks for the talk, Mark. You know, really enjoyed it. A lot of food for thought. Just my initial comments, reference to Peter's article and talk. You know, I actually remember the talk because I was the branch organizer at the time who invited him along to the branch to give the speech, give the talk. I think Peter's given a bit of a disservice to the early comrades in the SPGB. You know, I don't know if it's the article itself. I've not read it for a long time. It's not true. When the SPGB was formed in 1904, and it sort of one of its first political actions was to send two delegates to the Socialist International, which I believe was in Amsterdam, 1904, 1905, I can't remember which. And then they came back because they were a wee bit unhappy because the Fabians were there, the Labour Party was there, et cetera, et cetera. But it's unfair to suggest that the party immediately after that disengaged from workers' movement, from the Second International. If you do actually look at the standards from that period, I would argue right up until maybe 1916, 1917, party hoped, for one of them, you know, hoped if nothing else, that there was a minority of socialists within these reformist social democratic organisations. And that's why you see in the early standards the reprints from like the Italian socialist press, the French socialist press, the Guidists, the people in America, etc., and the business of them actually, you know, one of the first British left organizations, for want of a better term, to print Bolsheviks, you know, statement, you know, in the press, you know, the Litvinov, you know, front page of the Socialist Standard, and I believe 1915 or 1916. There was, you know, the party really wasn't that disengaged. I mean, it's a talk for another occasion. I'm more interested how the party, maybe from the 20s onwards for a long time, did become disengaged. Because I agree with Peter in that regard. I just think he's dated it wrong. I could say some other things, but let other people speak, you know, and maybe come back if there's, you know, other people are not contributing. Thank you.
Okay, Joel.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for the talk, Darren. Really good. Just on the point where the people have said that we sort of benefit from sort of gains made by other workers' struggles. I mean, mean, party members throughout its history have sort of been in unions or been shop stewards or some form of representing trade unions. So, I mean, I think it's unfair to sort of say that we've not done anything and sort of just sort of piggybacked on the back of other workers when they might have gained some sort of reform which can benefit the working class. Just a point. Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to make the same point, but anyway, Howard.
Thanks. I thought that was a fantastic parable, Mark. It reminded me of there's a couple of lines from a Bob Dylan song which says, "Some people say this world is one great prison yard. Some of us are prisoners and some of us are guards." You know, it's the way you put it was the power of the prison over people's minds. And that's what we're sort of up against, really. And I thought you sort of expressed that incredibly eloquently. And I thought your argument was a very subtle one, but I think the party's argument on reforms is a subtle one, actually. And that's sort of what you were expressing. I mean, we obviously don't support reformism. We don't support the kind of line that the Labour Party take or these sort of, you know, groups left of the Labour Party take, i.e. what they support is some kind of sort of more benign capitalism. At the same time, we don't say no to all reforms. We don't sort of say that all reforms are necessarily to be ignored because, you know, they just prolong capitalism. So I think, you know, there is that subtlety in our analysis, and it's not always that easy to grasp. You know, some people, even people who come into the party and then don't grasp it, and then, unfortunately, some anyway, finish up leaving for that very reason. You know, I've heard it said in the party quite often that once you've been in the SPGB, you've got nowhere to go. You know, if you drop out of the party, you drop out of politics. Unfortunately, it's not altogether true. I think quite a few of us can think of members who've left the party and gone to reformism, gone to the Labour Party or other such organisations. That's sad. That's unfortunate. But, you know, I don't think that's a reason for us to do things any differently. So engage, yes, in terms of not just damning all reforms because, you know, they're part of capitalism. But on the other hand, you know, making it clear that they're nothing to do with our with what we stand for. Thanks.
Well, sorry if I could just come in on that. First, thank
you. Okay, Mark.
Yeah, sorry. I thought that was like speaker's privilege to jump in. I feel delighted that you mentioned the Dylan song. I mean, I'm wondering whether I kind of that sparked it. I don't know, but I'm going to listen to that afterwards. I mean, one interesting thing for me is the question of class struggle and how we define class struggle. I was reading in Newell's book on the history of the Socialist Party of Canada, a debate around exactly right just before like 1902, 1903, where some people were saying that the class, and I think this is my understanding of where the SPGB stands as well, that the class struggle is just happens. I mean, it comes out, bubbles out naturally out of the relations that exist within every class society. And there were people who were arguing that there is no class struggle except the conscious political struggle for socialism, which obviously narrows, which then says many things are not class. But then I checked and I read a few things in the Socialist Standard, including by Steve Coleman, who emphasise that there's a variety of class struggle, because it's not even good struggle. I mean, it may even be wrong, but it exists. And if it is class struggle, and it is the struggle that means of the working class, the class that we are trying to come alongside of to teach them, then it just raises the question for how do we come alongside people, if you know what I mean, and as a party, not just as individuals, because that's one of the things that I have questions over, or not questions, but I know that many of our members are involved in different things. But what about our involvement? And when I say involved as a body, it doesn't mean we support, but we actually, like, for example, let's take as an example, an anti-war demonstration. Can any comrades imagine that we could be there with, as it were, our banners? We don't have to, doesn't mean we're supporting, you know, whatever, the latest anti-imperialist stunt of the Socialist Workers' Party, but we could be there as a poll where people could come to us and we could be giving them leaflets, telling them our position. Do we ever do that kind of thing? And if we don't, why don't we? Because, I mean, the reaction to a war and not wanting war is a good reaction. To side with one of the people, one of the capitalist countries, that's not a good reaction. So, you know, but the actual instinct of marching against war, in my opinion, is a good instinct. And how can we kind of connect with those? By the way, I first had contact with people who called themselves socialists, who I think are socialists, actually, in anti-Iraq war thing in Poland in the early 2000s. And I ended up joining the Polish section of the CWI, or in other words, the Socialist Party of England and Wales. And I was a member for some years.
Okay, on the class struggle, it's true that there were these arguments within the Socialist Party of Canada, but I think our party's position is that, as you say, the class struggle goes on, but it's got two aspects. One is if you like, an economic defensive one, which we participate in as individuals, and the other is the class conscious political struggle to, as you say, to get control of political power, if you like, the maximum, you know, the maximum program. So I don't think that it's the, although there have been members in the Socialist Party of Canada, even in the Socialist Party here, who've taken the position that the only class struggle is the struggle for socialism. It's not our official position or our official practice. And there's been discussions, well, before the war and more recently, as to whether we should participate in May Day marches with our banner. I'm not quite sure what the position is. I think it probably is that we could, but there's probably not enough of us to do that. Now, let me see who's next on the Dougie.
I thought that was an interesting talk, Mark. It raises a lot of questions. Right? I mean. I've been in the Socialist Party since about 1982, and I find, you know, that I've retired out of volunteer for Oxfam, so I suppose people might say you shouldn't do that because it's reformist, but it's something I enjoy, and in a way it does help people in some small way, really, you know. But, talking about anti-war marches, yeah, people do go on leaflet marches or whatever. The Socialist Party goes and leaflets protests and anti-war things and put the party case. So we do tend to do that, really, you know. One thing I'm worried about is if we ever get an MP and we start voting on reforms, you know, that are supposedly in the interest of workers. I'll give you an example. You know, the universal credit's been increased by £20, and the Sun had an article in their paper saying that puts 5p on a litre of fuel or whatever. So one worker wins and another worker loses or whatever. So it's difficult. Some reforms benefit the poorest in society, but they may have an effect on people who are in jobs and maybe a bit better off, really, you know. I think we should take the Sinn Féin position and not take the oath of allegiance and not actually be in Parliament to vote on these things, because it's a poison chalice, and I think it would. I don't know. I mean, I just think that's the position the party should take.
Mark, do you want to say anything?
No, it was great. Thank you.
Okay. Next one is Nick.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thanks, Mark. That was really an excellent talk. Especially the references to Rosa Luxemburg and the SPG in Germany. It's very interesting, quite thought-provoking. One of the things I picked up on was the sort of last part of your talk, which was about reaching out to other political parties or other parts of the social fabric. I wonder what whether we've thought about expanding, kind of beyond a sort of proletariat socialism, where by that I mean, the class issue with workers and the capitalist class. In that society is much more and diverse and beyond that. Why not try and include those people? I mean, there are a lot of people suffering coercion by the state, the blacks, women, gays. There are groups in the environmental movement like Extinction Rebellion, several ecology groups. Maybe it's even worth striking a dialogue with some of the vanguard organisations like the SWP, etc. I'm not sure what the general party line or the opinion is on that. That's me.
Okay, thanks.
I would maybe take that what Nick said maybe a bit further, or in this way, are those other issues like the Black Lives Matter or women's issues? I mean, I regard those as being class issues, because those are issues that affect the working class. I use the word proletariat quite a lot in the talk, and of course proletariat does associate in our minds and actually in history with the industrial working class, and so that's maybe why it's not so good to be using that too much. But I mean, my understanding of working class is the vast majority of society who are dependent on their labor to survive. So we are the laboring class, and the black question in the United States, of course, the blacks who suffer most are the working class blacks, right? Women in Poland today. In Poland, I don't know if you have been following it, but abortion has now been made basically completely illegal, even if a woman is carrying a baby that cannot survive outside the womb, because, for example, it doesn't have a head or a heart or something like that. And that is now illegal in Poland. Who is that going to hit most? That's going to hit working class women. Because, of course, let's say wealthier women will just jump in the car and head off down to the Czech Republic, pay a few thousands, and they'll be taken care of. But women in the small villages of Poland who have no money and are under the domination of the church, they're the ones who are going to suffer the most. Of course, it is an outrage against all women, but I do regard it as a class issue, because women are a part of the working class. So, I mean, that's my opinion, and I would be very glad to be shot down in flames if I said something outrageous. But I mean, so I'm just agreeing with with you, Nick, although I just simply would suggest that they may not be issues in which conscious socialists are necessarily involved, or but I think that they would actually be issues in which working class people are involved. And who influences those movements? Well, that depends on the people who actually try to do so. And I can imagine that for the soul of the women's movement, there you know, we could say that, you know, I mean, women's issues are legitimate socialist issues, I think. But we don't, of course, support the bourgeois women's movement, but we support the women, perhaps, who are under their influence.
Okay, thanks. Pat, do you want to say something? Or you're on, rather.
Right, yes, please. Just a comment first about the anti-war demos. Of course, someone has mentioned, of course, we do go and leaflet at these, and I have in mind the particular, the one that's against the Iraq war, and the million or so people that were out in London. Well, I didn't mind if I was counted amongst the numbers who were there against the war, but then you have to think what happened and what the demonstration didn't achieve. And on the argument that is sometimes apparently put, that we benefit from what others achieve, it should be remembered that reforms can be taken away. And if you think about the health service and the encouragement that there has been because of the problems of waiting to the extent of the private health care that people are pushed into having because of their waiting list. And I'm not talking about the current situation. I'd put the argument the other way round, that the amount of suffering and so on, as well as what I've just said about reforms can be taken away, there is suffering that there is because people have followed what I call the meantime party. And the real, things seem so much worse now because it is now. And I've been in the party quite some time, and you know, just see what the mental suffering and so on that there is, and what has just been said about the problems that affect certain sections of the community more than others. Well, I would say that the demand for socialism is a demand for the solution to these problems, and you know, that really is the only way for it to be dealt with. And of course, people are, as being said, involved in unions, and I can't see that there's any problem from going and helping out as my brother-in-law does at food banks and helping in that way. But really, it is the importance that the socialism is so desperately needed as the way to resolve the other problems. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay, well, we'll move on. Paul.
Adam, it's Jane and Tony next.
Right, shall I just speak then while we're waiting for everyone to come in? And let me just...
We withdrew.
Right. So let me...
Paul is speaking now.
Let me start off by saying, first of all, well done, Matt. That really was terrific. It really was a really well-presented talk there. And, you know, you absolutely nailed it. Full marks to you, comrade. That was... absolutely brilliant. The way I see it is, it goes something like this, comrades. I think that, sort of generally speaking, I mean, there was a massive event took place today in the High Court in London. In fact, the largest, biggest court in the land, the head, you know, main court, the last port of call. And it was the victory for the workers with the support of the trade unions against Uber, and how Uber drivers are now being recognised as employees and will get all sorts of backdated benefits from 6 or 7 years of perseverance of fighting this case to the Royal Courts of Justice. It was socialists, I don't think it would take a pretty brave person to stand up and say, oh, you know, I'm a socialist revolutionary, I don't agree with that. Of course it's got to be welcome. Any of these kind of concessions have got to be welcome. Some may argue that all that really does is prolong the agony of workers, whereas I'm inclined to believe that, you know, it is, you know, just a stepping stone on the way to our ultimate goal of world socialism. As a socialist, I think that our aim ought to be the creation of socialists for socialism, and that can take on many shapes and sizes and forms and on any platforms and any way you want to engage. I think I've mentioned before how I'm an active member of the Glasgow-based Poverty Alliance, and up until sort of pre-pandemic, I was going out and joining up with the European Anti-Poverty Network members in Brussels. And I wasn't going there to seek reforms. I was going there to discuss with other fairly similarly like-minded peoples about the possibilities of what is out there, to try and encourage people and educate them and persuade them of the possibilities of a complete transformation of society, and trying to give them the wherewithal to think about that and to learn about that and to try and take that forward. So, you know, I can understand the minimum maximum kind of paradigm and how you know, it can create, and it certainly does create benefits as well as, or advantages as well as disadvantages. But first and foremost, our role has to be both collectively and individually to put the party case out there in whichever and whenever way we can. You know, accept that what's going on around there, you know, or if not accept it, certainly welcome some of the positive changes like what happened today and how that will hopefully set the ball rolling for other workers in this so-called gig economy to try and get a better deal or a fairer crack of the whip than what they're already getting, and hopefully, you know, realise the potential that there is and how much better it could be. So, I mean, that's really just a bit of an observation that I wanted to make, as well as giving Mark a pat on the back for an absolutely outstanding and excellent presentation. Good on you, comrade. Cheers for now.
Okay, thanks. I think Steve has finished his cup of tea. Are you there now, Steve?
Yeah. Yes, I am. Thank you. Yeah. The reason also, if Tony wants to come in, I think he should debate before I speak.
You've got the floor.
If he doesn't, I'll speak. Okay, thank you. Just first of all, on a matter of our vocabulary, I was a little bit. I'm sure that Janet didn't mean this, but she's we're not in the.
Steve, you're breaking up.
In the case of socialism. Yeah.
Steve, you're breaking up.
Oh. Okay, give me a minute. I'll come back in.
Okay. Well, we haven't got anybody else, but I think there's a distinction between, which has been already mentioned, between what socialists do as collectively as a party and what we do as individuals. I don't think anybody, well, I mean, our position is that as a socialist party, we shouldn't have a minimum program. We shouldn't advocate reforms. I mean, the most we do with regard to trade unions, for instance, is we say we support the principle of trade unionism. But as individuals, socialists can do quite a wide variety of things, you know, apart from being active trade unionists. So quite a few have been mentioned. But I see that in the meantime, other people have appeared to speak. Darren, you want to come back like you promised?
Well, I'll let Jane and Tony. I've already spoken if Jane and Tony want to speak.
Is that okay?
I'm the chairman and you're speaking, Dan.
Hey, okay, boss. No, I just wanted to make just a wee bit this idea of what the party does, you know, arising out of Mark's suggestions at the end of the talk, you know, as a party doing something. Just a wee anecdote of why I'm kind of sceptical of things like this. I had a brief candidate membership of a Trotskyist organization. And this is what we would do. You know, we would have like fraction meetings before other meetings, and we'd kind of decide line. I'm not saying this is what Mark's suggesting. I'm just saying this is my experience of an organized intervention by a party. And we'd like have fraction meetings before the regular meetings of like trade unions or various single issue campaigns. And it just seemed so duplicitous. You know, it just seemed it seemed less about trying to engage with like a layer of workers who were on the same age as us in terms of wanting to do stuff, whether it be on trade unions or anti-war or racism, et cetera, et cetera. It was more about how do we kind of like put ourselves in a position, the head of this organization. That's my skepticism about any suggestions. And I'm not saying this is what Mark's suggesting, that once a group, once an organization decides to go in all in, you know, with the party line into like organizations other than themselves, I honestly think that this is what happens, you know, and I just think that that creates its own problems, you know. So that's why I've always been more inclined to what the party's position is, which is as individuals, you know, we get involved in various campaigns under our own steam. We're not getting the branch secretary telling us, you've got to turn up for this, you've got to argue this line, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just, I actually think that's more legitimate and more kind of honest as a working class socialist involved in campaigns other than those that the SPGB undertakes, which is, as Paul said previously, to try and make socialists. You know, that's all I've got to say.
Okay, thanks. Thanks.
Could I jump in there, Adam, just very quickly?
Yes, yes, okay.
Just wanted to say to Darren that I had the same experience actually in the Trotskyist party, namely the Polish section of the same organization as the Socialist Party of England and Wales. Yeah, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And yes, I do want to confirm that wasn't what I had in mind.
I'm sure I knew you weren't, but I just wanted to say it anyway. Thanks. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Jane or Tony? At last.
Yeah. Okay, so people have been talking about involvement in trade unions and individuals in different things, but the one thing I've always understood about the party is that its campaign runs for, if the object of the exercise is to run for elections and win a majority in Parliament. And then, so the question kind of that when I talked to somebody else about this, they said, well, okay, so they get a seat in the council or they get a seat in Parliament. What are they actually going to do? And somebody said, well, just do like Sinn Féin. And, well, Sinn Féin has a sort of position where they can do that because they've got a nationalist community behind them. And they're not aiming to get a majority in the English Parliament. I was just curious how people saw that actually working, because that does seem to be something that the party wants to do collectively. Hope that makes sense.
Well, I think that in practice, all a socialist councillor or a socialist MP could, in a minority, is actually criticise capitalism. But anyway, Paddy.
Hiya, I just wanted to offer a kind of another anecdote, really. Anybody who knows me knows that occasionally I've had jobs in the past in my sort of unhappier periods. And I had a job once working in the community, kind of sort of, you know, doing good things in the community. And I got really into it at first. I thought it was, you know, I felt like, oh, right, I'm down at the coalface here. You know, we're dealing with real issues here, you know, that really affect people. And, you know, there's a chance to really get things done and all this sort of thing. And this carried me through about, I suppose, a period of a honeymoon period of about, you know, 3 weeks. After which I sort of realised all the people that were kind of doing all this stuff had kind of zero, what I suppose you'd call macro conscience, you know. So I don't even mean class consciousness. I mean, I just mean no sense of any big picture at all, nothing. All it was just a few little cabals and tribes and sects of people all sniping, backbiting, gossiping, doing bits of power grabbing or empire building, and basically chasing their own tails. And I know from people who've worked on the council that it's very similar. That's very similar as well. I always think that the Greens, you know, despite what we think of their politics, I think the Greens deserve a bloody medal for putting up with that shit on local councils, local politics. Honestly, after 2 years of this job, I wanted to saw away at my wrists. This idea that, you know, think globally and act locally, all happens is you end up thinking locally and acting locally. And I just mentioned this because it just felt to me at the end of that sort of 2 years that this idea that you could be a socialist revolutionary and also be active supporting reforms at the minimum level, it just didn't seem possible to hold those two things in your head. One of them or the other gives way and collapses. And in the end, I couldn't bloody cope. I just went back to SPGB politics and felt immediately a lot more comfortable. Anyway, that's all I've got to say.
Right, thanks. Did you want to say anything about that, Mark?
Yeah, it's a lovely story. Thank you. And it just brought to mind, in my research, I came across an article by Stephen Coleman where he was talking about the reform roundabout, and there's a picture with it where you've got a roundabout like at a fair, and all these people sitting happily in all these little chairs, and next to the roundabout there's a bus, a big bus that says revolution, and there's only two people on board and they're waiting, and the people on the roundabout all going round going, we join you, no chance, at least we're getting somewhere. And you know, I think that's That is part, one of the attractions, one of the allures of the, let's call it the minimum program or the reformist approach, is you think you're getting somewhere. And I imagine that many people find, and I think many party activists in some of these parties, vanguard type parties, and what do they call it when you go into, when you do, what's it called? Not immersion. You know what I'm talking about, getting into other parties.
It's called entrism.
Thank you. My brain's blank. But, you know, you think you're doing something all the time. You think you're doing something. Then you burn out because you actually are not getting anywhere, just going round and round and round and round, especially when you don't talk about socialism, because you can't, because you've got to pretend that you know, that you're not a you've got to pretend that you're only interested in that reform. Nice story. Thank you, Paddy.
Paul, I'm interested in what precedence has been set.
The Royal Courts of Justice have declared that Uber drivers have to be treated by or as employees. It was in response to a couple of comments that had been made by other comrades. I think they might have gone by now. It's still there. Uber ruling only affects six Uber workers. The rest of them will have to fight their corner. But the decision has been made now, so that precedence has been set, and it effectively means that Uber workers, some of them who, you know, put in so many hours and they'll end up receiving a couple of quid, the equivalent of a couple of quid an hour over the course of their shift, also don't get any kind of benefits in terms of sickness or holiday pay. Well, now that they've been declared as employees rather than self-employed, they will be entitled to additional employment rights from Uber. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yes. Thanks. I see what it was referring to. I mean, that strikes me as something which a party member could have been involved in as an individual. But I noticed that in California, when they had a referendum vote on this, the people voted the opposite. Anyway, that's not the subject for discussion.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people. So just to come back to that, a lot of people, including people who do so-called, the gig workers or short-term workers that don't have contracts as such. A lot of them prefer it that way because it gives them their flexibility, and that may well be true for some people. But I think on balance, it's better to have more protections than fewer. If you get my drift, yeah.
Okay, Steve, again, you're not making tea.
Well, let's see if I can do it without breaking up this time. Is that better? Because I've put my headphones in.
I can hear you a bit better, yes.
Okay. A couple of points I wanted to make. Just to pick up on what Mark and Darren have said, what you've missed out, of course, about these lefty, the vanguardists, is the reason that they do what they do. The reason that they put forward these minimum demands is because they think that we as workers can't possibly understand our own class interests. Let's face it, that's what it boils down to. It's the Leninist nonsense about our inability to achieve a socialist, achieve an understanding of the need for socialism. So that's where that tactic comes from. And by the way, I just wanted to a little bit of nitpicking with something that Janet said before. We are not going to put any demands for socialism because that's not what we do. We are after putting our case to the working class. Demands is something that's come over from this leftist idea that we should put forward these demands immediately, because we know that the workers are not going to understand socialism. Therefore, we must put something forward. We must begin the political campaign, where the working class is at the moment. Yeah. So they don't understand the idea that there can be no fair wages. They don't understand that they're not going to achieve long-term benefits on the capitalism, but we'll put those forward just the same as demands. So that's just one thing. Socialist Party does not put forward demands. So if I could Mark was saying before, shouldn't we be involved getting out towards these other people? Well, actually, I just want to bring your attention to the fact that Kent and Sussex branch this Sunday afternoon have got a 3 o'clock meeting where they're discussing how to engage with students' unions in presumed trade unions within the post-18 education system. And we're also, as a party, intending to participate at the COP, whatever it's called, the environmental meeting that's supposedly going off in Glasgow at the end of this year, which was put back from last year. So of course party members do get involved in this, and we ought to get involved, and we ought to be doing more. So totally agree with that idea. I'll just leave it at that. I hope that was okay technically for you.
Yes, we can hear you quite clearly. Nick, that's just a comment, is it? Okay.
Yeah, that was just a comment, really, to back up, really, what Mark had said.
But I think it can also be attributed to the failure of, the various liberal and social democratic and centrist parties had the responsibility for governing capitalism, and they didn't make it work in the interest of the workers. So some of them turned towards Nazism, another consequence of reformism. Howard, your next one.
Thanks. Mark has been quoting Steve Coleman a lot, articles in Backstandards. Some of Steve's articles were very good. Actually, he was a better speaker. He was a brilliant speaker, as well as a lot of us know, in many ways a better speaker than a writer. But it's interesting that
the illustration of the roundabouts. Excellent way of looking at the situation. It's only a pity that, you know, afterwards Steve spent all his time and still does as an academic analysing the nitty-gritty of capitalism and never once mentioning socialism. So, you know, people can go that way, unfortunately, as well. But, yeah, obviously, if he's written stuff in past standards that are useful to quote, you know, let's do that. I just wanted to also reiterate something Pat said earlier about this, you know, so-called criticism of the party for sort of not supporting other organisations when they go for reforms, because at least they'll help, you know, they'll help workers a bit. Well, the point is that, you know, workers, as long as we don't make any progress towards socialism, workers keep having to do this. And, you know, for socialists then to get involved in this actually pushes the ultimate target, as it were, further and further away. So we can't do that, no. I mean, nor can we. I mean, I do agree with Mark that, yes, there are certain organisations and certain campaigns we can think of finding a way of engaging with while not sort of, you know, diluting our purpose and our argument. But, you know, I think somebody mentioned the Socialist Workers' Party. Surely not, because, you know, really, even if their analysis of capitalism is in some ways similar to ours, their aim, what they sort of looking to achieve, is really quite different. And, you know, we can't sort of mix ourselves up with them. Otherwise, you know, we really are putting ourselves in a position where, you know, we really don't know where we are. We really, you know, we've really lost the plot when it comes to looking at our ultimate objective.
Okay, thanks. Pat, I think Steve thinks you're Janet. Anyway, Pat.
Yes, that was partly why I wanted to say something, Adam, to point out that it was me, not Janet, that said. And that was just an unfortunate form of words, you know, when you're speaking. And I'm very rusty, as you might say, for being involved and speaking up about things. So I could have said going for socialism, and I'm very much support the view that getting socialism needs the conscious and political understanding and organisation. We're certainly not in the way of you know, going out and demanding that the government does this and that. No, we are. I'm very much support the view that this is for workers who form the vast majority, but to organise to take. to take the world, as it were, and the suggestion or the concern about what would happen, you know, for if we just began to get a trickle of MPs into Parliament, I would suggest that is extremely unlikely. That when the ideas are taking off, they cannot but take off rapidly. And the time that you've got sufficient people to be voting for the parliamentary route, which is what it would be, then we would be, I would suggest, sort of well on the way to achieving socialism. And wouldn't that be nice? Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. It's always good to hear you, and you always are very articulate. I had in my notes, and I didn't know where to put it, so I thought I could chuck it in. It sort of relates a little bit to what Pat said, but there, it's often pointed out by the Socialist Party that if there was, or when there is, a mass socialist movement, and you know, the capitalists see their hour coming, they will actually be chucking reforms at us, because and you know, or trying to kill us, or both. It's rather interesting to we will we are, we've I think it's been said that we know that the final, you know, the party that when there is a mass movement, where we will be in the mass movement, we just don't know, do we? We don't know what things will look like. And, you know, the idea of having lots of MPs, it will raise all sorts of questions. And of course, there will be a desperate struggle with the capitalists, and they will use every tactic, including bribery and murder and whatever it will they will do until they decide that they're going to have to withdraw. So yeah, but you know, the best way of getting reforms will be to have a mass socialist movement, ironically.
Okay, discussion on Uber. Okay, Paddy.
Yeah, I just want to go back to this prison analogy that Mark started with, and that some people were, you know, sort of quite admiring of, and I liked it as well at first, because I thought, well, you know, yeah, it's quite an elegant, quite accurate sort of analogy from our perspective. But then it occurred to me, but it only really works once you already understand our perspective. From the point of view of a non-socialist, somebody who doesn't really understand socialist politics at all, it would come across as very abstract, very unlike reality as they understand it. Life just doesn't seem like a prison when you're born into it, and when, you know, previous generations have been born into it. Like, you know, capitalism just seems natural, which we know. And of course, people also know that capitalism is a lot better than what came before. So I think the prison analogy kind of works for us with our understanding, but I'm not sure that it works for workers in general. So for them, you know, the idea of breaking out of the prison rather than getting thicker blankets doesn't really make sense to workers. Reform is the natural thing to aim for, and revolution is the oddball, is the unnatural thing. Of course, our job is to kind of reverse that perspective. But also, I think harping on the idea of prison and confinement and guards and guns and bars and all this sort of thing, you know, it could tend to reinforce a sense of powerlessness of workers, and also the sort of deadly force of rulers. And I think that could be quite unhelpful, really. And it puts across a picture of the socialist case as being, you know, this narrative that we all live in hell and heaven is over the rainbow. I mean, it just doesn't wash with workers. You know, they know it's not hell. At least in advanced capitalist countries, for most people, most of the time, it's not hell. And they know which side their bread is buttered on. So what I would suggest is, I don't think it's a particularly useful analogy, at least not to be put into workers. What I tend to think is a better way to approach workers, maybe it's just me, but it's to talk about the freedoms that people have got in capitalism and the things that are good about capitalism, but then to go on to say, socialism will be a lot better. Socialism is a massive improvement. All the things that you like about capitalism will be even better in socialism, plus a lot of the things that you don't like we won't have. And so in this sort of formulation, reforms aren't, you know, we can then say reforms aren't bad in themselves, but they're not going to get us to socialism. They're not going to sort of, you know, well, this is what we say about reforms. But I do sort of question this kind of negative capitalism is hell type formulation. I think it's off-putting. I think it makes us sound like sort of curmudgeonly whingers. And it doesn't wash with most workers' experience.
Mark,
may I? Yes, I agree completely, Paddy. I mean, this just to be clear, this is a parable for us to consider the minimum maximum issue in the context of trying to see how the situation in Europe, in an autocratic 1840s Europe, when the Communist Manifesto was written, how that compares to modern capitalism. Certainly was not an appeal to workers to try to persuade them that they were in a prison. I take the positive that you said was that it may work for us. Certainly shouldn't be used as a sort of a my wife is being, Sally's being very supportive. She said it helped her to understand the issues. So there. Obviously, I absolutely 100% agree with you. It came to my mind when I was trying to work out how do we look at the differences in the time, the periods in which Marx and Engels were operating versus the end of the beginning of social democracy and that kind of thing. So it was just an attempt to do that. But I agree entirely with your comments as to if that was our presentation, that it would be all the bad things that you said. So fully I take on board. And it was very, very, I enjoyed listening to that. Thank you. Good, it's a good criticism.
Okay, Brian.
Yeah, I have to disagree. Most certainly. From my experience of talking with workers in Cardiff on the high street there, in Queen Street, quite a few of them come up and say that they feel trapped within capitalism and how do they get out of it? And I put forward the analogy, yes, capitalism does seem to be and appear to be a prison with no escape and specifically with no bars, but the bars are pretty apparent when you look for them. I mean, wage slavery itself is a bar, right? But the solution is of getting out of capitalism is to challenge it politically. And you most certainly can't challenge capitalism unless you recognize how it appears to some people. You know, appearances are deceptive. For some people, it seems to be quite okay, you know. And to others, you know, it seems, we're stuck here, we can't do much about it, you know, so take it on the hoof, like, and that's it, like. You know, so the prison analogy can come in under certain circumstances, depends on the context, you know. And it's always best to remember that when you use it, just talk with the working class, not talk at the working class.
Do you want to say anything on that, Mark?
Thank you. That was great. Thank you.
Right. Anybody else got anything to say? We've had our 2 hours. Vin, okay.
I've had some jobs where I really have thought I've been in prison at the end of the week. And on Sunday afternoons...
Can't hear you, Vin.
Okay.
We can hear you, but not loud enough.
Okay, is this any better?
Yes.
That's fine.
Yes.
Okay. What I was going to say is that I have done lots of jobs where at the end of the week I've felt it's been feeling like prison. And in particular on Sunday afternoons, knowing that, you know, at 6 o'clock I was starting a shift of 8 hours. You know, I don't think I can identify with the prison analogy.
Okay, thanks. Right, John.
I also can identify to a great extent with the prison analogy and have the exact same experience. And that's in all sorts of jobs that I've done in the past and in the present. I grudge every moment that I spend in the service of the capitalist class, but it's one of those things that's forced upon me. But I do recognise that it can be worth pointing out the positive achievements of capitalism. But notwithstanding these, we would never be satisfied with capitalism.
Okay, thanks. I'm sure Paddy wants to come back.
Oh, just a quick thing. I think maybe I didn't make myself clear. I was talking about workers who are not class conscious. I mean, you know, we recognise, we completely relate to the prison thing. I do as well. Of course we do. And so do the people who come up to Brian on his stall who say that they feel trapped by capitalism. These are people who are already starting to be class conscious. But I was talking about the sort of vast majority of workers who are not even anywhere near that, you know. So anyway, so that's my point.
Okay, Howard.
Just wanted to say, Adam, that as people have been talking, I read the article, the link to which you've put in the speaking queue there about the effect of the Bolshevik coup on development of socialism. Article by Gilmack from the 1960s or something, strongly recommended, very well worth reading for anyone. Just thought I'd bring it to people's attention.
Yeah, I put that up because it confirmed something that Mark had mentioned. Right, Hard or Dick.
Hi, Pete. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
That's great. I was going to eliminate that queue in the queue, but since I'm here, I don't want to sound like I'm mounting a pincer attack on Paddy, but long before I became a socialist, I was doing jobs in which I was clock watching, and anyone who is clock watched is actually in a capitalist job, is actually in a prison. But by definition, I mean, they may not define it like that, but we can certainly, I think there are certainly ways in which we can understand it in those terms. That's what I wanted to say.
Okay, thanks. I suspect quite a few non-socialist workers feel the same. Right. Anybody else want to say anything? I have John.
Yes, just a small thing. In my place of employment now, we had a manager who once was talking about people being able to retire rather early due to various packages that were being offered. And the employers referred to it as early release. And he actually voiced that. He said, sounds like a prison sentence. And I and a few others shouted out, well, yes, that's exactly what it is.
Okay. Right. So we think we've had our 2 hours. Do you want to sum up at all, Mark?
No, I just thank everyone for some really great contributions. And just to assure anybody who hasn't done this that it's actually not as bad as you might think. So maybe there are some other people who want to do it who haven't done it yet. And thanks very much for your kind, positive comments. Much appreciated.
Okay, well, thank you it so happens that I'm the person that arranges for the program. So anybody that speaks, I write to and invite them to give a talk. So if you speak too much, you'll get an invitation to talk. Okay, I think the meeting can close now, but people wanted to continue to talk afterwards, I think, about other things. Oh, next week it's Kevin Cronin on the strange case of Northern Ireland. It's the 100th anniversary of the creation of this mini state. So that's next Friday at 7:30. I don't know what's on Wednesday, but there'll be something. Okay, so that's the official end of the meeting. People can hang around and talk. Okay.
Oh, dziękuję, Marco. Dziękuję, Marek.
Dziękuję.